Welcome to the Python Perspective. Since its premiere in October 1969, Monty Python's Flying Circus has induced alienation and devotion, culminating in 2014 with what was announced as 10 final live performances in the 16,000-seat O2 Arena. On the 50th anniversary of each original television broadcast, we look back at the series and ask, what was innovative material then, what continues to be successful now, and what have people thought about it along the way? I'm Ben, librarian and critic, and joining me again is my co-host Nathan, improv comedian, actor, and scientist. Welcome back, Nathan.
Good to be back. Thank you, Ben. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Today is the 50th anniversary of, actually, I don't have the date, the broadcast date of this episode written down. I have its recording date and its screenwriting date. So let me just confirm that it is the 50th anniversary of the 22nd of September, 1970, when the second episode of the second series of Monty Python's Flying Circus was broadcast. And the reason I have those other dates is because they are so different from when the broadcast came out. Numerous times last series, we talked about how it was written maybe 1 or 2 weeks beforehand, but the pre-production of this series was much, much earlier. And the first two episodes of Series 2 were not broadcast in production order. In fact, they were bumped to episodes 25 and 23, respectively. Episode 3 became Episode 1, and this is now the second episode, but was the fourth in the production order.
So who at the BBC would have made that decision? Would that have been the designers or producers or just higher up program managers?
I don't have a good answer to that question, unfortunately. I can tell you that one of the reasons why there are so many jokes in this series about program planners and program managers is because the Pythons were very dissatisfied with some of the pre-production liaising with the BBC. As mentioned previously, they were in a new time slot, and one of the things that the new time slot offered was the opportunity for regional BBC franchises to decide not to air the program. There's something about the 10-10 slot that made it so that BBCs throughout the country could say, we're going to do local programming instead of airing this. That it was post-watershed and therefore available to be ignored. And one of the ways in which the BBC attempted to mollify the Pythons was by saying that they would have earlier and more repeats, that it would go back into rebroadcast circulation quickly in order to give people an opportunity to watch it if they missed it on that first airing because of local stations choosing not to broadcast it. But that still made the Pythons very unhappy. And this is part of a larger trend that we alluded to briefly last episode when we talked about the recording of their first album with the BBC, and that they went on to a private label after that. They were more and more interested in controlling their ability to get to their audience, and that the BBC wasn't necessarily allowing them to do that. Did therefore the Pythons say, this is one of our best episodes, let's make sure we lead the series with our strengths? Or did somebody in production say, we don't like the first episodes, let's bury them and then only have them come out towards the end of the series because we've paid for them, we might as well broadcast them? I don't have the answer to that question. But it's something that I can continue to research as we continue to press on through this series of episodes.
It's interesting looking back how much the BBC viewed this asset as something that was expendable. Now it seems kind of ridiculous that they would be so fickle with the programming being kind of loosey-goosey, not quite so guaranteed. But at the time, I guess they thought, well, regional, I suppose that means far away from London. Those people will not care about this strange comic group and may want to see something else or wouldn't complain if they don't see Python. But I guess maybe it was not really clear if that was a good or bad choice at the time.
Right. At the end of this series, there will be an episode with the Queen possibly watching. And there are some internal memos that were released to the public in 2006. And the minutes of the meeting has the head of the features group saying that certain sketches in that show were disgusting and that it had gone over in, quote, appalling bad taste, unquote. This was a year in which they were on that tipping point of becoming more popular, and therefore more and more people were paying attention and criticizing what was there instead of it just being a fringe thing that nobody really cared whether it was successful or not. So I think that investment as to is this good or is this not is part of what emerges this year.
Okay.
I happen to have that article in front of me because I was looking into the ending of the episode, which is perhaps the worst way to start our conversation, is to talk about the last words that appear on screen. But I was surprised in retrospect that the last spoken words of the episode are,
"Oh, bugger,"
where it's Michael Palin's Cardinal Jimenez says right after the screen goes black and the words "the end" come up. Mm-hmm. And I have always enjoyed that particular bit of British slang. It's felt saucy, and it's one of those things you can sort of get away in America with saying because it's not slang there. So if it is offensive, nobody really notices. Mm-hmm. But in 1970, it was fairly controversial. It had been only as of 1965, according to one source, that the BBC first started allowing that word to be used in primetime broadcast anyway. So to use it was the Pythons definitely pushing the envelope. I found a sentence in a book that we've referred to previously, Monty Python, The Case Against by Robert Hewison, where they talk about the fact that sometimes in the later series, they had to bargain to get rid of certain words and certain phrases in order to keep ones. I'm not sure that this episode is an example of they wanted to keep the bugger at the end. There's a chance that maybe since this episode goes to 30 minutes and 15 seconds, that there's a chance it might have gotten cut off. And so BBC might have allowed it, because there was a possibility that it wouldn't have gotten aired in the first place. It might have just run over enough that they would have left it behind. But the show notes by Andrew Pixley that accompany the network Blu-ray also point out that originally the script for this episode included a sketch that ended up in a later episode, that there was a running through line about profanity. This is where the Semprini sketch originally appeared, which is a sketch that has a number of censored words appear on screen with asterisks supplanting vowels or characters. And therefore, originally, the "oh bugger" at the end would have come up with a subtitle that then had the vowels removed as part of that ongoing censorship of the naughty words that weren't allowed to be said earlier. And then the end was also going to come up with the vowels removed as if it was a saucy and salacious word.
I see.
All of that, of course, doesn't exist because they lifted that sketch out and did it later. But I also wonder, was that one of the bargains that is alluded to, that they moved that sketch there because to have a sketch about foul language would have gone too far? And so they were only allowed to have the bugger in this if everything else was clean and unworrisome.
So the bargain being this particular sketch falls on an episode which has a pretty clean script.
Yes. We'll bump the sketch about censorship and bad language to another thing so that we don't have too much of a focus on bad language in one episode. That we spread it out a little bit so as to not to make people too worried.
But surely that would have been at the script level, right?
Yep. So the script was completed on the 14th of April in 1970, and all of those sketches are included in that script. But it was recorded on the 2nd July of 1970, so that there was a degree of finalizing of the production work, that the live filmed bits had to go out and be worked on. So with all that pre-production and pre-planning built in, somebody at some point may have said, let's cut this and do it later in order to keep these things in now.
Okay.
So we've now talked about the very end of the episode, but without much context. We've talked about the pre-production of the episode. Let's get to the middle. Nathan, this episode is generally referred to as the Spanish Inquisition, as it's the through line of a trio of sketches that run throughout, but that doesn't necessarily mean that's your favorite. What do you want to start us off with as what were your three favorite sketches of the episode?
I tend to go through these in a chronological way, so I list them down as I see them. So it really is not a least favorite to most favorite or vice versa. But top of the list, because it happens first, are the jokes and novelty salesmen.
Jokes are guaranteed amusing, as used by the crowned heads of Europe, has brought tears to the eyes of royalty.
And for this, I'm including the whole kind of tail end of the previous sketch where there's a knock at the door.
Mm.
John Cleese opens up and says,
Ah, hello. You don't know me, but I'm from the BBC. We were wondering if you would come and answer the door in a sketch over there.
I've always loved this sketch for the reason that you're coming at it from, like, you're a production, you're a boom operator or you're an audience member, and you're seeing everything happen kind of behind the scenes.
Mm.
And then you awkwardly walk into what is a very bad sketch. And that take on it, I just love that. Every single time I watch it, I always enjoy. I mean, first of all, John Cleese's smarmy character with the horrible soul patch.
Oh, man.
And the things that he says to sort of undercut the professionalism at the BBC are really fun.
It's all a bit zany, you know, a bit madcap fun stuff, Frank Adam. Probably understandable. So the kids seem to like it.
I like Eric Otto's performance, and Graham Chapman is kind of the doe-eyed, fish-out-of-water kind of character who gets caught unawares that, oh, wait a minute, I'm supposed to say something.
Do the punchline. What punchline? The punchline for this bit. I don't know it. Didn't say anything about a punchline.
I enjoy all of that.
Fish out of water is a great description because I noticed, not for the first time, but with increased clarity, how strange it is that he starts off wearing the vest and cap and costume of a mill worker from 1911. I'm sorry, New Year's Day 1912. And then he gets in the BBC production van and is brought into this house. Nothing about them isn't from 1970. Eric Idle's joke man, the truck, the goatee, all of it. So the fact that he's unable to finish the sketch because they don't properly inform him what his line should be is only fitting that they also don't give him a wardrobe change or anything else, and that they just treat him like raw material. We just need you to stand there. Perfect. Sign this. We're going to use your head in an animation.
Also, they do not even drown out the sound of the van in the background for the entire sketch.
I wondered
about
that. You
can hear it blaring in the background for the entire kind of one-sided exchange from Eric to Graham.
I sort of expected that once Graham would come out of the house for Eric's part of the sketch, that would be in studio. But it wasn't until this time rewatching it that I did notice that low thrumming of the semi the entire time. And I realized, no, this is all still on film. They cut the angle so that it's better focused on the two of them in the doorway.
Mm-hmm.
But that whole segment, however many minutes it is, from this is a link, isn't it, to we're going to use your head in a bit of animation, all of that is filmed prior. And that noise drones on underneath it because to get rid of it would have required too much work. I suppose they also could have just turned the truck off, but.
My sense is that whole keeping the truck on, it was a deliberate choice, I think, on everyone's part to make it seem like it's such a stage thing.
Mm.
It's meant to feel like, oh, this is just the guy we had hanging around who could drive a truck. This is the best we could do. It's not even your house. We're just going up to a doorway to have this sketch go on.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it reeks of like unprofessional behavior at the BBC is running the whole show. That's a bit of a deep cut, which would not come through, I think, to the modern watcher, maybe even to the contemporary watcher. But watching this now and discussing what you and I have just talked about in terms of schedule engineering, I sort of feel like there's a little bit of a bad blood starting to form between the six boys and the BBC.
I think potentially my favorite part of that sketch is the internal meta commentary on the fact that Python so rarely uses traditional punchlines. And this is something we've talked about in the past, that the Lorne Michaels produced special on Monty Python featuring a number of people from Saturday Night Live, that they talk about one of the things that they're envious of is that the Pythons don't need to have necessarily as clean of a button on their sketches as SNL and various other comedy sketch groups felt obligated to do. And this sketch deliberately undermines that by having Graham say, "You didn't tell me what the punchline is." John Cleese's controller character reads it, laughs.
Very good. Very good. What a good punchline. Oh, pity we missed that.
But doesn't tell the audience what it is. So that's how incompetent the BBC is. They don't even fix it. They just keep the punchline to themselves and move on, which is brilliant. It's such a mean thing to do to the audience, but it also means that Eric Idle doesn't have to work hard to come up with a perfect button. It is an Ouroboros of screw you guys, we're doing it our way, that I find incredibly enjoyable.
That and the follow-up line of sign here and you'll hear from us in a year or two to get paid for being an extra.
And I have no idea how accurate that is, but it does follow hard on the kind of bureaucratic commentary that was in the gas cooker sketch from the episode before.
Right.
Of the idea that it might take 2.5 hours, but if somebody dies, somebody will get around here eventually to help you out. Which follows on a little bit from the lack of ending of the Spanish Inquisition sketch, of course. That the Spanish Inquisition is equally incompetent in being able to torture its heretics. Mm-hmm. I don't know if this was a sketch you were going to talk about. Should I leave this alone and we'll come back to it, or do we want to jump to it now?
Well, let us move on. My favorite sketch number two is Spanish Inquisition.
Now, which of the three Spanish Inquisitions?
This is important. So I'm going to say right now that when I meet people who say, you know, I really don't like Monty Python, I don't know, just something about it, it just doesn't ring funny. When I watch the very first appearance of the Spanish Inquisition, I know exactly how they feel. Because I sit there, the whole audience is falling over themselves laughing. I know both you and Mark loved that sketch. But I watch that, I'm like, I don't find it funny in any way. I mean, I get why it's supposed to be funny, and I just don't like the performance from Palin. But the second and third iterations, I find hilarious. So it's a qualified favorite sketch, where if you break it up into thirds, I like the second two of the thirds better than the first.
I understand that completely. And it is fascinating that the second of the three instances of the Spanish Inquisition is where you get the real introduction. Like, that's where you get the title sequence. That's where you get the animation over the Bruegel art that explains the history of it.
In the early years of the 16th century, to combat the rising tide of religious unorthodoxy, the Pope gave Cardinal Jiménez of Spain leave to move without let or hindrance throughout the land.
The first introduction of it feels like the second instance in a running gag, whereas the second instance feels like the first instance. It sounds, that's where you actually create the context for the audience. And I watched it thinking, would this have worked better if they'd started with the second bit and then had the beams gone out askew on the treadle as the follow-up, because then it becomes the escalation? Would Graham's repeated line of,
"I didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition,"
ring funnier as he gets less and less surprised by the Spanish Inquisition coming in?
"I didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition."
If we had already been introduced to the idea that they come and show up when you say that phrase. I don't know, obviously, because I can't unsee it the way I've seen.
Well, clearly the second iteration is funnier now that you know that it's them and they're going to come in here with the horns blaring and say, "Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition." So when you see them, you're like, oh, it's the goons from top of the show. to me, all the first iteration does is it introduces the second one, so you're kind of like primed to like smile at it. So if it were the other way around, yeah, I can't really get the optics of what that would be like. I mean, the first one is a sketch that never really starts.
Right.
And it's frustrating. And clearly, Carol Cleveland and Graham Chapman are frustrated as well, because their characters just, they go out the window and they just become themselves.
Graham's delivery in the first Spanish Inquisition sketch is particularly odd to me. First of all, he kind of blows his line. When he first is telling that the beam has gone off skew with the treadle, he starts to say it before Carol gives him his feed line.
Trouble at mill.
Oh, no. What sort of trouble?
One on cross beam's gone out of skew on treadle.
I also think that the bizarre, zany content of him dropping the northern accent so he can be understood.
I don't understand what you're saying.
One of the crossbeams has gone out askew on the treadle.
Doesn't seem to be part of the sketch. Like, it really feels like it's going in one direction. That this is a, I suppose that could be part of the charm, is that you think it's going to be one kind of a sketch, and then it gets totally shanghaied by the Spanish Inquisition rushing in and taking over.
Mm-hmm. Could be. It's hard to know what they were thinking about it at the time.
Mm.
If it has some other meaning, like, again, kind of incompetence, as we mentioned, the three cardinals can't even do what they say they're going to do, and they can't even define what they're going to do.
Incompetence is definitely part of the subtext. Obviously, the first one being when Cardinal Biggles takes out the dish rack from underneath his robe, displaying a very nice pair of scarlet red briefs and long legs, which show up great in HD, by the way. When he pulls out the rack awkwardly, Michael's reaction to that is one of utter frustration, and he comes towards the camera to be in shot. He's already able to leap forward to this is never going to work. That's what we're supposed to read in his face. And it's hilarious, therefore, that Fang and Biggles aren't able to figure it out until they have to twist the rack and realize that they can't do so.
Cardinal, give the rack, oh dear, give the rack a turn. I know you can't. I didn't want to say anything.
Palin's Cardinal Jimenez recognizes that immediately. The other two cardinals have to catch up.
Mm-hmm.
That built-in incompetence is definitely part of it, following hard on the fact that they can't say their introduction in a smooth way so that they're ruining their own element of fear and surprise because no one's scared of them and they're not surprised because they've done it three times.
Yeah.
Whereas in the second segment, it's not that they brought the wrong tools for the job. That premise is built on the idea that these are deliberately the tools that they think they should use, but they're not. They don't understand why it's not working.
Cardinal, poker with the soft cushion!
You don't have Palin's character say the line, "Do you have all the stuffing up in the end of the soft cushion?" Because he's disappointed that the soft cushions are the only tools of torture that they have to use. He says it because this is supposed to work. We're poking you with soft cushions. That's our element of torture. We've got all the stuffing up at one end. Why? Why won't you submit and confess?
She's made of harder stuff.
That is, therefore, a surrealist take on the idea of instead of hot irons, we have things that are comfortable. We won't let you out of this chair until lunchtime, except for a break for tea at 11. That's based on the idea that they don't fundamentally get that their tools are dumb. Whereas in the first sketch, he's angry that the tool that they have is the wrong tool for the job.
Let me ask you a question.
Yeah, hit me.
In the first arrival of these cardinals, Terry Gilliam's character does some kind of dance with a grunt for like maybe 1.5 seconds before he's cut off by Palin.
Uh-huh.
My own man. That's enough!
And the audience goes berserk. And I have no idea what he's doing. And my note was maybe it's a thing from 1970. Do you have any information on that?
I do have some information on that. Daryl Larson comes through in a pinch.
Here you go.
To tell us what the song is. So what Gilliam says in the little dance before Palin's character cuts him off is, "My old man said..." This is from a Cockney English music hall song, writes Larson, "My Old Man," which I don't have the melody to this to heart, but the rhythm is vaguely like this. My old man said follow the van and don't dilly-dally on the way. But I dillied, I dallied, I dallied and I dillied. I lost the van and don't know where to roam. It's essentially a comic song about the fact that a man is moving. His moving van has his address in it. It leaves him behind, so he doesn't know where he lives anymore.
Hmm.
I don't know why Cardinal Fang wants to break into that song. It doesn't feel like a natural extension of anything he's talking about. I don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have a good answer for you as to why he would be going into My Old Man. It doesn't seem to match his bizarre, rootless accent. It doesn't seem to match what he's been talking about before that. It doesn't seem to match anything. Similarly, his name doesn't seem to match anything. Cardinal Jimenez, obviously a member of the Spanish Inquisition. Cardinal Biggles, totally ridiculous that you would take Biggles from the World War I Flying Ace stories and put him in the Spanish Inquisition. Cardinal Fang? I don't know. Where does he come from? There's no explanation for it. It's just Gilliam's weird, pulled down, growly face where he stretches out his bottom lip and exposes his teeth in sheer terror. His whole bit doesn't track. So, no, I don't know.
I do like Biggles' costume. I do like his costume and I like his mustache.
Mm.
Anyway, the Spanish Inquisition. It was a thing from our youths. I remember you would say that a lot.
Mm.
And not having been as facile with the material then, I never quite got like what it was about. But everything that we've talked about, I think, is relevant to it. And I like how incompetent they are at actually doing the torture that they want to do or showing up to where they're supposed to show up to.
I think Palin's delivery is great. I think the camera work lets him down. This is one of a couple of sketches that I have been irritated with because they haven't had a good place to put the camera that properly gives the actors the best opportunity to do their work. The trio of the Inquisitors are blocking each other a little bit in this sketch. And the way in which they're framed means that Graham's action, where he gets frustrated and bored and lights his pipe, doesn't happen in a way that is at all useful to the television audience. I think they probably had two cameras, and they didn't have a really good sense of what was the right way to put them on camera so that all the different bits that they were doing got properly captured. For me, Palin's delivery is his vocal work, the way in which his voice goes up and down and the things that he does, but he doesn't always do it in a way that is visually useful for the television audience. So this has been one of those sketches that works for me better on Monty Python, The Complete Ripoff, where it's restaged as an audio reinvention of the sketch. This sketch is near and dear to my heart, not because of the way it is here, but because the way in which they reclaimed it once they had the audio-only medium for it.
Hmm. That's a valid point. My only complaint with his performance is some of what he says gets lost because he's speaking so quickly.
Mm.
And some of his gestures are just a little bit too quick to be picked up on the low-lit, grainy medium of the film at the time.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. What did you feel about we talked about the first bit, we talked about the second bit. How did you feel about the ending? Did you like the way in which at the close of the courtroom sketch, when you once again have the rule of three and you pull, I didn't expect the Spanish Inquisition out, and everybody in the courtroom turns and looks to the door, expecting the Spanish Inquisition to rush in?
Well, my good friend, this actually is one of my favorite moments. So, yes.
Do we want to save it for moments instead of sketches?
I think we should save it for moments.
Okay, fair enough.
I will say, though, that I did pause and look at the book that Gilliam is carrying when they leave the bus.
Indeed.
It is a 1969 publication called The Encyclopedia of Witchcraft and Demonology. Potentially the most heretical book one could be carrying.
By Russell Hope Robbins.
It's a very subtle joke, which is almost invisible. And I just have the DVDs from 1990 whatever, so mm-hmm. And you have the Blu-ray, so hopefully it was easier for you to see. But I had to pause and then kind of interpret based upon, and I can only get it really because of the way the book looked.
I think they had an opportunity to more prominently show that off on film, and probably because it was film, they didn't do multiple takes of it. It was probably hideously more expensive. And so the Blu-ray footage of that is just as blurry. High def, but blurry, because while he's angling it towards the camera, it's in motion the whole time. So I think potentially they'd intended it to be visible when they were in the flat and they were sitting around reading. I think that's where they probably thought that it would be like, oh, as you sit in London drinking tea and relaxing, this is what Cardinal Fang would have as his reading material. How to look out for this sort of thing.
Okay. My third favorite sketch, court charades.
And how do you find the defendant? Two words? First word.
I love everyone's performance in it, and they all play slightly different versions, including Carol Cleven, nice background barrister. Probably top of that list would be John Cleese and just how bad he is at guessing. What is so obvious what they're going for, that they're in a courtroom, they're talking about a new case to come up, that this is what they get hung up on.
I gotta say, this is why it surprises me that this is one of your three favorite sketches of the episode. I assumed that that tension of everybody knows that if you're about to start a next case, the phrase the judge is going to say is call the next defendant. And therefore, the sheer cluelessness that all of the guessers have at being able to figure out what the next syllable is, I expected would be very frustrating to most people. But you're telling me that the fact that they're so clueless is actually the part of the joy of it.
Yeah. I mean, even the ladies and gentlemen of the jury, how do you plead? The first thing he says is not, what else could it be? But they go through the whole, he's impersonating being a fish.
Fish wheeze? Fish wheeze. Fish breathe. Fish breathe throat. Fish breathe throat. Gill. Gill.
But then it's like, not gill, and they still can't get tea, not gill cup. I know it's a very simplistic thing to have written, but I just find it really funny.
There are two parts of it that I think help elevate the sketch. I love how irritated Palin's jury foreman is that when the judge passes the sentence of not guilty on our defendant, that he doesn't have the ability to protest it. He just looks like, no, that's not what I was going for, but you're a judge. That's the sentence going forth, and I guess I just have to shut up and sit down. That's great. And I also like at the end of call the next defendant that he pulls a giant model of an ant out from behind his desk and everybody cheers. In my opinion, they were even getting a little tired of their own sketch. They're like, okay, so having them guess the syllables that everybody knows is a little weak. We need to punch this up a little bit. And so they went straight to absurd. That, to me, is a nice escalation, a nice changing the stakes of where they are in the sketch. The giant ant, I forget about it each time. Like, it's one of those things where I'm like, okay, I know what we're doing. And then, boom, giant prop ant is legitimately a hoot.
I wish they would have been able to mis-sentence the guy in the front at the top. Not Gilcup. We'll be taking you down to the gallows. It will be executed at noon. Would have been a fun twist. They didn't go there.
Yeah, that would have been good too. And what about the second half of the sketch? Do you just prefer the charades part, or once Terry Jones's judge is put on trial?
Call the next defendant, the Honorable Mr. Justice Kilbracken.
Does the
right once they kind of do their phase shift into more realistic tone, which is quite stark. You can see on Eric Idle's face. Call the next def and ant. Call the next defendant. That shift. I find the second half of the sketch also enjoyable.
Okay.
Mostly it's the overuse of the word mullud, which is not a word I associate with jurisprudence except for in and about just Monty Python.
Mullud and mother lud. The prosecution will endeavor to show mullud that mullud, not you mullud, that mullud.
And then having, is it Rita Fang? Is it who comes out?
Yes, according to the script book, it's Rita Fang. T-H-A-N-G.
Okay.
Exhibit A, my lord, Miss Rita Fang, an artist's model.
Which is a piece of slang for, well, if you are Miss Thang, then you are a body. You are somebody who's a little bit hot to trot. And so obviously bringing out this artist's model as played by Beulah Hughes, who played the nurse in episode 13, Intermission, and goes on to be one of the line of bikini models in How to Recognize Parts of the Body, as well as being one of the party goers in Salad Days. You know, she's wheeled out on her little exhibit cart, and she's just there to be attractive.
Now, the accused then commented on Miss Thang's bodily structure, made several not at all legal remarks on the subject of fun.
Things like a Swedish accordion teacher. It does seem like they're just kind of tossing things out there which are a little bizarre to add a little bit of flavor to what is now just us all looking at this one woman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when she's revealed, nobody really does anything. There's no laughter. There's no applause. She just kind of sits there and kind of like shakes her hips around. So there's a little bit of a lull in the action, which is then, I think, brought back up pretty nicely between the exchange of the, I guess, barrister Cleese and the two judges. And I find Graham Chapman's end, I mean, sort of launched a diatribe of how he really can't do the kind of sentencing he wants.
Ooh, England makes you sick. Best I can manage here is life imprisonment. Hardly worth coming in the morning.
I find that interesting and funny.
I will say this. There is some indication that this sketch was written quickly. Going back to what we talked about, some of this script was repurposed and re-edited between being finalized on the 14th of April and being recorded in July. One of the other things that Pixley claims is that in addition to the Semprini sketch, there was also going to be a sketch about Police Constable Pan Am. And so this whole charades bit may have been made up relatively quickly in order to fill space and time. And so similarly, Graham's rant, while highly enjoyable, is very strange. Mm-hmm. He even has a little bit of that kind of filler language built into it, where he goes,
I'm off, I'll tell you. Yes, I'm up to here with probation and bleeding psychiatric reports. That's it, I'm off, that's it.
That's not tightly written, the fact that he's repeating himself in the middle there. It sounds more like me on this podcast than it sounds like scripted material. And so I wondered if there was a little bit of fudging going on in order to make time in that sketch, that that might have been something that had been in draft form that was repurposed.
Yeah, now that you mention that, I can't see that.
I had that minor irritation with the sketch already, and it was therefore interesting to see that Pixley claimed that there had been some revamping of the script at some point. Because my first thought was, there's no way they could have included the naughty chemist and police constable Pan Am and had this script come in at under 30 minutes. Like, not a damn chance. But then when you start to watch that sketch with that eye of this may have been fabricated closer to the time, you get a vague sense of maybe they were stretching.
Let's do the Monty Python Minute.
So using the random number generator at random.org, we have chosen a minute within the 30 minutes and 15 seconds of the episode for Nate to watch and review. He then has 30 seconds in which to summarize the 60 seconds that he's watched. If he is successful at summarizing the entirety of that minute, he will have a bonus point as we go into our quiz section. Nathan is watching minute number 24. That's minute 24.
Not Gil. Second syllable. Not Gil.
Nathan, are you ready?
I am.
And your 30 seconds to summarize begins now.
This is the court charade scene where we have Michael Palin giving, trying to tell the court what the verdict is without actually saying it, and they guess not guilty, and he may leave the court a free man. Then they try to call the next defendant by getting through each letter and syllable by doing a charade, and that was what Graham Chapman's doing just until the end of the
10 seconds left.
The woman who is the tortured woman is actually the woman. She says, fish, and we have...
5 seconds left.
John Cleese giving totally random and Eric
Hill's
good guesses. Words fail me.
I think you started to get a little bit like, oh, I've summarized most of this. I can relax. I don't have that much left to do.
Yeah, you know.
I usually, because I have advance notice in order to write the trivia and upload the clip, I know what the random minute is. We don't determine that live. That would be a pain in the neck. But then I try to steer the conversation slightly away from that particular minute so that our conversation can be new and fresh as we talk about it. But nope, not when it's one of your three favorite parts. Unfortunately, there isn't that much more that we need to cover about this.
This is true.
So let us plunge straight into the heart of the trivia competition, where I'm going to ask you five questions about charades.
Okay.
Question number one. The Encyclopedia Britannica says that a charade was a game of using rhymed riddles to have participants guess a word by having each syllable turned into a crossword-style clue. So the game of guessing things based on gestures and mimes was not the original meaning of charades. In fact, these were these poetic puzzles. They give a four-line riddle example of a classic charade. Nathan, can you answer this riddle? My first syllable is an ottoman. My second syllable, a letter. My all is a country. No Christmas dish better.
First syllable is an ottoman. Would that be Turk?
And so if your second syllable is a letter...
There's no, like, category for this word.
Nope. Except that the third line says, my all is a country.
Oh, so Turkey?
Turkey. No Christmas dish better, according to the Brits. Question number two.
Yay!
So, charades, the plural of multiple charade, evolved into the mimed game that we know of today over the course of the 19th century. When it achieved popularity in the 30s and the 40s in the United States, it wasn't called charades. It was in fact called a strange Piranha Brothers-esque reduction name. Was it referred to as A, the game, B, the gestures, C, the syllables, or D, the guesses?
I would go with B, the gestures.
Oh, unfortunately, it was the game.
Oh, no way.
It's so weird. Moving away from party tricks, let's get into the heart of why I was so excited to research this minute. Charade was a 1963 movie starring Audrey Hepburn and Cary Grant. Directed by Stanley Donen, Charade has a vague one-step-removed Python connection. Which of the following is it? A. Donen, who was famous for the dances in Singing in the Rain and Funny Face, trained Arlene Phillips, the choreographer for Every Sperm is Sacred. B. Donen directed the 1967 film Bedazzled, starring Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, whose Beyond the Fringe inspired Cambridge Circus and eventually Monty Python. Or C. And this one's either hideously complicated because it's true, or hideously complicated because it's false. You'll have to figure out which. Martin Amis wrote both The Rachel Papers and Donen's film Saturn III. Both films were made in 1988 for an 89 release, which caused delays as Amis had to tinker with rewrites on both scripts, which threw a monkey wrench in Terry Gilliam's 1988 Baron Munchausen because Jonathan Pryce's commitment to The Rachel Papers prevented him from doing reshoots.
That's gotta be C. It has to be.
Nope. It's Bedazzled. Bedazzled was directed by Stanley Donen.
No. Well, I knew Bedazzled was a movie starring Peter Cook and the other guy you named. I knew that was true, but I didn't think it was actually the connection that you made. So.
Yep, it is a weird one in his repertoire, but no weirder than Saturn III, which is about a robot that gets taken over by Harvey Keitel and tries to murder people.
All right.
Question
number... Any more questions? How many more questions?
Two more questions. Question number four. In charade, Audrey Hepburn is pursued by three menacing figures. One of these three character actors, like John Cleese, both guest starred in an episode of The Muppet Show and had a cameo in one of the Muppet films. Was it A, Ned Glass from West Side Story and Herbie the Love Bug, B, James Coburn from The Great Escape and Duck, You Sucker, C, George Kennedy from Cool Hand Luke and the Naked Gun films, or D, trick question, it was Tim Robbins who menaced Tandy Newton in the 2002 charade remake The Truth About Charlie.
Let's see here. Well, I have not done too well on any of these, so it doesn't really matter, does it? The name I thought you were going to say, you didn't say. Mm. I thought you were going to say Walter Matthau. I was prepping myself to go for that, but it's not him, because he's not there.
No, as far as I know, Walter Matthau was in neither a Muppet Show episode nor a Muppet movie.
The Muppet movie is just replete with cameos,
right.
So I thought maybe he would have been in there. But I have not seen The Truth About Charlie, so I'm just going to go Tim Robbins. Number D.
Unfortunately, it was James Coburn, whose Muppet Show episode is great as he tries to teach animal meditation and calm.
There you go.
Final question. This is for all the marbles. Due to a quirk in copyright law, anyone who owned a copy of the film was able to make their own copies of it because it was not protected, making it a mildly hot commodity in the DVD boom of early 2000s. Copies of Charade could be found produced by every fly-by-night cheapo convenience store DVD company. How many different copies of Charade do I own on video? A. 8. B, 13, C, 16, or D, 20?
Let's go with B, 13.
There were two correct answers to this. The answer 13 is correct. That's how many I own on DVD. But if you also add in the numbers of Blu-rays, VHS, and Betamax, then it gets all the way to 20.
Fantastic. You did ask me how many video copies you own.
I did. 13 is therefore correct, which gets you to 2 out of 5 answers correct in the quiz. And I don't know, did you win the recap or not? I think you did.
Yeah, I took a little detour,
right,
and gave some ancillary information.
Right.
So I must have had time to do that. So I came to the end of it.
100%. So you got 3 out of 5. Nate, congratulations.
That's more than 50%. That's a D. So now we have come to the top 5 moments of this Monty Python episode. Moment, just to remind our listeners, is a short bit of taped studio audience footage, some film, some cartoons, a character, gesture, anything, not necessarily a full sketch, that just makes us smile, just because it does. Ben, can you give me a top favorite moment?
I'm going to say Julius Caesar on an Aldous lamp.
A tale so gripping that they said it could not be filmed. A unique event in cinema history. Julius Caesar on an Aldous lamp.
Is a great presage of what we eventually get with the... Shoot, its name has gone right out of my head. In Monty Python and the Holy Grail, when you have the Beast of Arg,
mm-hmm,
and the whole conversation about the fact that he would have just said Arg, he wouldn't have bothered carving it. When Julius Caesar gets stabbed and goes down typing out A2 Brute on an Aldous lamp, it's a good pre-introduction to the kind of lunacy of who would really say these sort of things in their death anyway. I like that bit. I like it in general as a weird escalation of where we got to from the Wuthering Heights in Semaphore before that, but also just as a predictor of where they would go later. It's a nice middle step.
Good. I like that.
What about you? What's on your list of 5?
I'm always eager to point out lines or just bits of dialogue that I adopt from Python that I like to use in everyday life.
Yes.
The phrase can do but won't is a personal favorite of mine. I would love to be able to say this to someone with complete sincerity. If I could do that maybe just once a month, I would be on cloud 9.
For listeners who don't remember that specific moment, that's one of the things I believe that John Cleese says to Graham Chapman right before he gets his head cut off. Do I have that right?
That is correct.
Can you give me a lift back?
Can do, but won't.
And Cleese just flat out says no. Okay, Ben, third favorite moment.
Third favorite moment, despite your mild disapproval of the first third of the Spanish Inquisition, I think that there are a bunch of great moments in there. I think it's hard to dislike subtitle and caption overlays. Those are always some of my favorites. So the dual diabolical laughter / diabolical acting that comes up over that is fun.
Soon change your mind about that.
But it's the diabolical laughter of Cardinal Biggles that I want to single out. The fact that he continues to give his sharp barking ha after the diabolical laughter is over.
Now, Cardinal! Crack!
All of the characters in that scene are doing their own little game. It's kind of like an improv, where each one of them has their bit that they're doing in the scene. Carol Cleveland is playing her character from 1911. Cardinal Fang is doing his strange I don't belong in this scene bit. Graham Chapman is playing I'm annoyed that I'm in this sketch in the first place. They all have their particular point of view and perspective. And Cardinal Biggles is that he's not in sync with anybody else. It also helps make his glassy-eyed, I'm just going to keep turning this invisible crank, regardless of the fact that it's not doing anything. His character is great, and those ha's are part of it for me.
Carrying on the Spanish Inquisition theme, I'm going to put the number 4 on the list is the entire court turning and looking at the door when the Spanish Inquisition is summoned.
I sentence you to be burnt at the stake.
Inquisition.
Which is a good bit on a lot of levels, particularly because, and I keep on using this word this episode, it's a piece of escalation. The first time they come in, they're unexpected, but then the joke is they become increasingly expected as they go out and come in and go out and come in and go out and come in. The second time, we're not aware of the fact that this is a running bit.
And this is the Spanish Inquisition hiding behind the comb shed.
Until Carol Cleveland, quite surprised, says,
"Oh, I didn't expect the Spanish Inquisition."
It's a random thing to be happening in the middle of these photographs that she's tearing up. And so we are as surprised as she is that it comes back. But in the third instance, everyone expects it. They're all looking at the door saying, where are they?
My note here is, I think this is the reason why I liked the Spanish Inquisition and labeled it as one of my favorite sketches. It adds a nice button to the end. And just as you summarized right now, is it's an arc where you don't expect it. And then all of a sudden you expect it too much. Mm-hmm. And I find that it not being there and all of a sudden cutting from studio to film and having them run to the scene where they're supposed to appear and not getting there on time. It's funny.
I don't know. What's I think is only mildly undercut because they're only on screen for like half a second. But when they did run on, they didn't make the courtroom wait for that long. Because everyone's pretty much in the same pose that they were in as they turned looking at the door expectantly. I sort of wanted everyone in the courtroom to be knitting or gone or something because they'd been waiting for such a long time for them to get there. But because it cuts to black so quickly, you don't really notice that they're all actually still in the same poses. Mm-hmm. But it's redeemed by the fact that the studio audience laughs like crazy. There's a high-pitched wail of laughter.
Nobody expects the bugger.
Accompanying them running in and swearing. That is, it helps underscore and make the cut from film to live studio audience successful.
Yes.
Do you want number 5 or do you want to give me number 5?
I'd like to give you number 5, please. Here we go. What is it?
I'm going to say that in general, I agree with you about why the gag seller was such a good sketch in that it was all about the weird meta bits of Cleese's program planner. I like the pacing of it. I like how long it takes for them to get there. But the part that makes me the happiest is how mean they are to program planners by saying,
I'm mainly in comedy. I'd like to be in program planning, actually, but unfortunately, I've got a degree.
And I think we've been actually referring to him as the program planner throughout, where actually that line proves to us that he's not. Mm-hmm. But boy, that's harsh. If you're smart enough to have gone to college, you're too smart to be a dummy that's in charge of the BBC. That is some cold water. It also reminds me of a moment in Sneakers where Robert Redford's character, when he's talking to two CIA agents, goes, you know, I almost joined the CIA, but then they found out my parents were married. And this guy almost murders Robert Redford. Like, he gets so mad.
I'm very happy you said that as one of your top favorite moments. And I, too, love that point from Sneakers. And interestingly, I had the exact same thought every time I watched that movie. It's like, yeah, that's right. But I will say they're from the NSA.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. There's good stuff in that movie. There was a couple of articles recently about how good of a sleeper that is, how it's an underrated gem, and how it's had a long tail of influencing people. Like, there's a NASA patch out there. I believe it's NASA, where they have C-Tech Astronomy on their patch because they liked it so much. That detail's probably wrong, but it's an article for Wired. And if you out there, listeners, have a secret love or not-so-secret love of sneakers, I suggest you track down that whole retrospective on it, because the details will be accurate there, where they are not accurate in my memory.
Hi, Future Ben here. Past Ben was correct pretty much only in that his memory was inaccurate. Otherwise, the patch was for the NRO. The article was from Slate magazine, and it wasn't recent. It was from 2012. So don't go auditioning for the part of Mr. Memory in Alfred Hitchcock's 39 Steps quite yet, Ben.
It's this is straying off the Python topic, but that is a very underrated movie.
Uh-huh.
Fantastic cast, very well directed, well written. Phil Alden Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like Sidney Poitier getting back into acting. It's one of River Phoenix's last movies.
Right.
Dan Aykroyd is just the density of talent in that movie is fantastic. Ben Kingsley.
Yes.
I just think, I know this has nothing to do with Python, but just thinking back on the dialogue that he has with Bishop in that little sort of soundproof room about mm-hmm. how the internet basically is going to change the world.
Right.
And we're sort of living that a little bit more real right now is a little creepy.
Yeah, it was a smart script that could see 5 minutes into the future, and we're definitely there now.
Yeah. Anyway,
Marty,
that's for a different.
I know
different...
you are in the building, and I know you can hear me. You should not have come back, Marty. I won, and you lost. And if our friendship had meant anything to you at all, that's the way you would have left it. But you always had to be the one to win, didn't you?
I'll check as soon as I finish pounding these breasts. This episode of The Python Perspective was conceived, researched, and performed by Ben Russell and Nathan Emley. Sound design, also by the two of us.
The theme song is by John Philip Sousa and sourced by Creative Commons clips from the archive.org community.
Editing was done mostly by Ben. You can find us at firstperspective.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at firstnamebasis. This podcast is an intellectual exploration of the context and lasting power of comedy. In this case, the comic phenomenon known as Monty Python's Flying Circus.
If there are things, dates, names, gestures, giant ants, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect, please contact us via the website, and we'll post it to our errata page on farceperspective.com as soon as possible.
Once again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Nathan, and my co-host is Ben.
Confess! Confess! Confess!
I confess! That we'll see you next time when we discuss episode 3
of series 2.
Deja vu.